This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Truth, War, and Consequences is the title of the report on the season premiere of the PBS investigative series Frontline. It's about the infighting among the Pentagon, State Department, and White House over the intelligence that was used to make the case for war in Iraq and the planning that was done to create an orderly post-war transition. My guest Martin Smith is the reporter and co-producer of this edition. He's made several Frontline documentaries that have focused on terrorism, including The Terrorist and the Superpower, In Search of Al-Qaeda, and Hunting Bin Laden. His Frontline documentary, Truth, War, and Consequences, airs tonight on most PBS stations. One of the people you interviewed for the show is Ahmed Chalabi, who was a major source for the Pentagon in its pre- and post-war planning. Just tell us briefly who Ahmed Chalabi and the Iraqi National Congress, which he was part of, who they are.
The Iraqi National Congress was founded in 1992 in the wake of the first Gulf War, founded by Dr. Ahmed Chalabi, who comes from a banking background, and he has probably done more to bring about the fall of Saddam Hussein than any other person besides George Bush. Civilians in the Pentagon have been enthralled with him. He's at the same time a very divisive figure, a controversial figure, who many in the State Department and the CIA revile. That's not too strong a word, given the kind of controversy that he stirs up in Washington.
What kind of information did he give the Pentagon that the Pentagon used to make its case for invading Iraq?
He provided defectors. He actually received money from the U.S. government, and he used that money to attract and pay defectors. Now, he has said that he has only provided three defectors, but if you talk to people in the intelligence community, it's much more than that. And his organization, if it wasn't Ahmed Chalabi himself providing the defector, has also provided information and defectors. So Richard Perle, the Defense Department advisor, told the New York Times that Ahmed Chalabi was, I think the quote is, without question, the single best source of intelligence the U.S. government had on Iraq.
What was Chalabi telling the Pentagon about weapons of mass destruction?
Well, he was making a case all along that Saddam Hussein had current and active programs. And the problem here is that Iraq was a black box. It wasn't well penetrated by our intelligence services, so we relied on defectors. And people in the intelligence agencies will tell you that defectors are a risky bet because they have other motivations. And these guys were getting money. They also knew that their bread was buttered by the INC. The INC had a political interest in seeing Saddam fall, and so the defectors knew that if they brought information that the INC wanted to hear, it would be well received.
If the Pentagon trusted Ahmed Chalabi and the INC as a source, how come the State Department did not?
The State Department was dubious about the idea of backing any single Iraqi exile. The idea that the State Department had was that we should move into Iraq and allow Iraqi exiles to come back home and to let Iraqis in the country organize themselves politically and not come in with a preordained, backing an Iraqi exile group from the get-go. So it wasn't so much that they all distrusted Chalabi, although there were those that did. They'd had some bad experiences in the middle of the 90s in which they had backed Chalabi. He'd received CIA contacts and money, and he was running some operations in Iraq to try to get an uprising going. And he provided intelligence to the CIA and the State Department that was deemed shoddy. The depth and breadth of his support was deemed not what he was claiming it to be, and that soured many people in the State Department on what this guy represented.
Another source of disagreement between different branches of the Bush administration was the weapons of mass destruction. Was there definitive evidence of weapons of mass destruction? Where did the Pentagon stand on that?
Well, the civilians in the Pentagon believed that there was enough evidence. They had felt that the CIA, the DIA, were biased, that they didn't evaluate the intelligence of weapons of mass destruction or the evidence of links with al-Qaeda, you know, between al-Qaeda and Saddam fairly. They thought that the CIA had biases against believing that al-Qaeda and Saddam could work together. So they formed their own small intelligence unit in order to essentially second-guess the intelligence that was coming out of the CIA and the other agencies.
And what did they find with this Special Intelligence Office?
Well, the Special Intelligence Office is a bit of a secret. We don't know exactly what they found. We do have some information that they were looking over the intelligence that existed and reevaluating it and sending it back up the to policymakers. Much of it was apparently intelligence that had been ignored or discredited, and they pulled this back out of the file and say, "Hey, wait a minute, look at this." One example of that was reports of meetings between the 9/11 hijacker Mohammed Atta and an Iraqi intelligence officer in Prague. This got into comments that the vice president would make on Meet the Press. This was information that had been discredited by the FBI. They determined that Atta could not have been in Prague when those supposed meetings took place. But yet this would live on, and this would continue to be repeated by the vice president. This was the kind of thing that the Special Intelligence Office would take a look at and say, wait a minute, we think this could have happened. We think this is good evidence. And so they would ship it on.
Now, you interviewed Ahmet Çalabi for your report, Truth, War, and Consequences. And you asked him about his claim that he had evidence that there were links between Iraq and al-Qaeda. What did he tell you?
It was an interesting exchange that I had with Ahmet Çalabi. I'd met him in 98. Because at that time, after the African embassy bombings, I was investigating al-Qaeda at that time, and I met with Ahmet Çalabi because he was making claims about al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein then. And I asked him again about that in the program, and he said, indeed, he had lots of evidence that there were links. And I said, do you have any documentary evidence of any kind? He says, yeah, there's such a document. And I said, well, I'd like to see that. That's important. In fact, that's a reason we went to war. One of the major explanations for why we needed to go after Saddam Hussein. And he then sort of twisted and did promise finally to show me the document, but then never was able to do so. He's now said that he can't find it. It's a kind of dog ate my homework excuse, which I can't quite buy.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Martin Smith, and his report, Truth, War, and Consequences, will be broadcast tonight on most PBS stations as part of the Frontline series. Another subject that you investigate in Truth, War, and Consequences is the planning that went on within the Bush administration for what would happen in Iraq after the invasion. The State Department had created something called the Future of Iraq Project, and this was created before the invasion of Iraq. What was the goal of this project?
The Future of Iraq Project was... the idea behind it was to draw on the Iraqi exile community, engage Iraqis in thinking hard about the problems that a post-war Iraq was going to face. This ranged from, you know, how to keep law and order on the streets to how to keep the water and electricity flowing after the war. I mean, all of these very important questions that we failed really to address in the post-war period, in the immediate post-war period, and still struggling to address them. So that they engaged about 200 to 300 Iraqis in about 15 different working groups, all looking at various aspects of post-war Iraq.
And what did they recommend?
Well, the problem with the Future of Iraq Project is that there was no head to this thing. I mean, it was a lot of seminars, a lot of talk, but there was no single synthesis of this material. Because essentially the project got cut short. It got cut off before it could come to any kind of synthesis. So it's hard to say that there were any. In fact, many of the reports, and there were pages and pages of reports, were in Arabic and never got translated in such a way that an American official in Iraq could even read them.
You also interviewed members of the military, and some of them shared with you their frustrations that they were unequipped to help prevent looting and to keep order.
Well, they were unequipped to keep order. They hadn't had that kind of training. They aren't policemen. On the other hand, I talked to General Conway, who headed up the Marines, heads up the Marines there, and he said that they basically stood by for several days and watched the looting with a kind of passive attitude because they weren't told to do otherwise. This goes back to the rosy scenario. We had an understanding. I mean, if you remember, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld talked about stuff happens. This is when you give people freedom; they're going to run wild a bit. And it was kind of an attitude that this wasn't such a big problem. The problem was that our concept of looting and their concept of looting were worlds apart, and the kind of looting that took place was so crushing to the infrastructure of the country that it set us back, far, far back.
So did members of the military who you interviewed tell you that they wish they had been given orders to stop the looting once it started?
Yeah, I found it almost exasperating talking to General Conway when I asked him about that, and he said that they had pretty much watched it with the attitude that it was something like a redistribution of, sort of a much-deserved redistribution of wealth. And I said, well, but as you realized it was going further than that and it was crushing the infrastructure. I said, did you get on the phone and call anybody say, maybe we ought to stop this? And he says, no. Basically, he waited for orders, and the orders didn't come. We sat by and we allowed this to go on.
In your frontline story, several people you interview make the point how unprepared the United States was for the looting. But one person you interviewed talks about how he tried to convince the Bush administration to prepare for this because he'd seen it in other countries. What did he tell you?
This is Robert Perito, who works for the U.S. Institute for Peace, which is a government-sponsored think tank in Washington. He was invited by Richard Perle to come make a presentation. Perle had seen one of his monographs, his papers, and Perito was an expert on post-war situations. So he came to the Defense Policy Board in February 2003, just a month before the war really began, and said, based on his experience in studying post-war situations in Kosovo, Bosnia, East Timor, Haiti, Panama, in all of these situations, what was paramount was to have a police force on the ground operating immediately after the fall of the existing government to prevent looting and disorder and rampant crime. His presentation was to take 30 minutes. The Defense Policy Board, which meets just off in a conference room right next to Secretary Rumsfeld's office, had him there for 90 minutes. They were very interested in what he had to say. He even was told that he was likely to come back. I couldn't talk to Richard Perle about this because Perle says that the discussions that take place at the Policy Board are off the table, off the record. But in any case, Perito did speak about it. He did make this presentation. But when he talked to the reconstruction team, they told him, well, they didn't really know what was going to go on after the war, so they were going to wait and see and then make recommendations later. Well, that proved fatal.
Another controversy that you look into in your frontline report is the issue of whether people who had been in the Ba'athist Party, Saddam Hussein's party, should be allowed to participate in the reconstruction of Iraq. In the first phase of the reconstruction under General Garner, they were allowed to participate. Then when Paul Bremer took over the reconstruction, he started a de-Ba'athification program. What was his explanation for wanting to ask, to get Ba'athists out of the reconstruction program?
Debathification, again, was a key platform plank of the Iraqi National Congress, that the basic assumption was that the Ba'athists were so, had done so much harm to the country that there was no way that anybody who was in the, you know, top 40,000 Ba'athist technocrats, bureaucrats that had anything to do with Saddam's government simply couldn't stay. They had to go. This was a controversial proposal because there were other Iraqis who said, you know, we need a smooth transition. Many of these people were Ba'athists out of need, not because of belief, not because they were committed to Saddam, but simply because they were people who had chosen to get by. So they said, look, we've got to keep some of these people in place. And Garner was going about with that approach. And when Garner was let go and Bremer came in, Bremer basically removed some 30 to 40,000 people from ever working again in any government position. And these people then had nothing to do. Some people will say that these people then become a major problem for the occupation in that they support the so-called resistance.
We've talked about the importance of Ahmet Çalabi's role in making the case to go to war. What and how controversial he was, you know, how the Pentagon supported him and the State Department distrusted him. What is the role of Ahmet Çalabi now in the new Iraq?
Well, Ahmet Çalabi is one of the members of the Iraqi Governing Council that was appointed by the coalition, by the administrator, Paul Bremer. So he's one of the 25. It's now 24 because of the assassination attempt, the successful assassination of one of the members. So he's one of 24. He no longer enjoys the kind of backing that he would have hoped. Bremer realizes that it's going to be a long and slow process of building a democracy. On the other hand, there still is pressure coming out of the vice president's office and some of the civilians in the Pentagon who would like to see a quicker turnover of power. Ambassador Bremer seems to understand, from what I can gather from talking to him, that it's going to take time to build institutions that will stand up a real democracy. You don't want to rush into an election before everyone that counts has a chance to organize politically and put forward candidates.
You went into your frontline documentary, Truth, War, and Consequences, with a lot of questions. What are some of the questions you come away with now that you've completed it?
That's a good question. I think I have a lot of the same questions. You know, I still have the questions about the intelligence. It's not my contention that the administration was lying, as many believe. I think they believed that, I mean, they interpreted the intelligence. Again, the intelligence was spotty. So I still have questions about how they were able to take such spotty evidence and turn it into the kind of, as I say, clear and unambiguous message that they did. I have questions about why we listened so much to the rosy scenario, you know, we will be greeted as liberators, sweets and flowers, when there was lots of evidence on the table that this wasn't be the case. So those are still the big questions.
Martin Smith, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Martin Smith, his frontline report, Truth, War, and Consequences, will be shown tonight on most PBS stations.